Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's cool fact of the day is that endurance training doesn't leave any memory in your muscles. It turns out that your muscles don't have long-term memory for exercises like running, biking, or swimming. That old adage that once you've been in shape, it's easier to get fit again is probably a myth, at least for endurance athletes. Relatively small study conducted in my wife's home country of Sweden in 2016 showed that when muscles take a break, they really don't maintain muscle memory from prior exercise. In the report, people trained one of their legs 4 times a week for 3 months, and then they took 9 months off. And the study authors took skeletal muscle biopsies, from both legs before and after, and found the cells in the muscles expressed over 3,000 genes in different ways after the exercise. But after they had their fitness hiatus, the scientists couldn't detect any exercise-related genetic changes between the people trained and untrained, at least the people's legs that were trained and untrained. And the study author, Malene Lindholm of the Karolinska Institute, where my wife also studied, says, "We couldn't see any differences at the gene activity level. Most effects are lost by a month or two of no training." And some study participants next trained both legs and they had similar results, but all study participants grew lots of hair on their legs. Okay, that last part I just made up, but the rest of it was all good. How's that? I've never made up anything in a cool fact of the day until right now after almost 600 episodes. I've been really patient. Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
This is the first episode I've recorded after coming off stage at the Bulletproof Biohacking Conference that we held at the Beverly Hilton this year. And
nice.
Man, it was a pretty epic, conference. I had so much fun there. We had 1,200 people and just the best time, best yet out of 6 years. So that constant improvement thing, I think we nailed it this year. And today's guest wasn't at the conference, which is a very sad thing and something that I'm going to shame him for later on the show.
Oh, you got to invite me.
And he's an invitation, information. What, you don't have social media? His name is Scott Carney. He's an award-winning investigative journalist and anthropologist who writes these cool stories that blend narrative, nonfiction, and ethnography. And if you're going, what the heck is that? Don't worry. This is totally tied into biohacking. Because his reporting has taken him to some of the most dangerous and weird corners of the world. He also wrote a New York Times best-selling book called What Doesn't Kill Us, How Freezing Water, Extreme Altitude, and Environmental Conditioning Will Renew Our Lost Evolutionary Strength. And this just came out in paperback. And now you understand why I've got Scott on the show, because these are classical biohacking themes. The idea that the environment around you controls your biology. Well, he put it to the test because he's a little skeptical, kind of like I am. So we're going to talk about human endurance and why effortless comfort is hindering your health and how the wedge can flip your neurological script. Scott, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me on, man. And thanks a lot for citing my book in Game Changers. You give me a shout out. I really appreciate that.
It was actually really cool to be able to cite you in Game Changers. Scott, you are kind of an odd duck because you were going to get a PhD in anthropology, which is a weird thing to get a PhD in anyway.
Yeah.
And then you said, oh no, I'll get journalism, which this is a bit of trivia. It is the lowest paid on average career you can get from a four-year degree. Did you know that?
Anthropology or journalism?
Journalism is actually lower than even sociology or anthropology, believe it or not.
That's actually shocking to me because I know a lot of very broke anthropologists in the world. But it doesn't really surprise me because journalism is very difficult. And I did not get a journalism degree. I am somewhat proud of this, is that I dropped out. I got to the dissertation of anthropology. And I got to that point where I was like, oh man, I'm going to write this really cool ethnography at that point it was a Bollywood film. I lived in India for a long time. We can go into that later. And then I was like, wait, but only 5 people are going to read me. And I was like, oh no, journalism. And I made the switch. And I made it in a funny way, is that I was broke, as grad students are. And it was the summer. I was like, oh man, I need money. And I looked in the back of the newspaper and it was like, it was actually the back pages of The Onion, which was, I had a print edition at this point.
Yeah, love The Onion.
And it said, you know, come join our clinical trial for the erectile dysfunction drug Levitra. And, you know, we'll pay you like $5,000 to like sit in penis poppers for a month. And I was like, that sounds hilarious. And it's good money. And so I joined this clinical trial and I wrote about, and I met all these people who were making their living going from clinical trial to clinical trial.
I read this piece. That was you?
Yeah.
It was a fantastic piece. Oh my God. That's hilarious. Thanks, I did not know that was yours.
Yeah, that was, that was probably the first big piece that I ever wrote. And then I was like, wait a minute, there's money to be had in journalism and I get to have adventures around the world. It made me really psyched. And then I started writing for Wired and Playboy. Well,
you kind of got to be a badass. So the asterisk in the journalism, that's the average that people make.
But great.
I mean, you wrote for Wired, and by the way, it hasn't published yet, but we just did a photo shoot for Wired at the Bulletproof Biohacking Conference, which is kind of cool. Nice. So I'm going to be at least in the online edition, maybe print, who knows? Cool. But I mean, outside Mother Jones, NPR, Playboy, Foreign Policy, like you're kind of a big deal when it comes to writing, which is awesome. But I did not know that basically your experiences with erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
Sorry about that, it's man. True. That those were the source of your career in journalism.
Well, not in that month. That month we were all on penis poppers, me and 30 other dudes in that research trial. And I made money, all right, with my erection. Man. So yeah.
I had no idea we were going to go there. I thought we were going to go straight to cold showers, and I'm completely confused at this point.
I'm a tough interview, man. I got to say, you know, you're doing great. You're doing great, Dave.
Well, what attracted me to talking with you is you're in Game Changers because you've done some just cool, fascinating stuff. You're a very curious guy. And because you study anthropology, you're actually a systems guy, which means like, how did it get to be this way? Why is it this way? And what does it take to change it? Which is kind of cool. So you got into this idea, you know, the what doesn't kill us around human endurance. And you decided in 2011, right around the days when I was starting the Bulletproof blog, and I did a ton of ice baths and was also into Wim Hof at the time and still am. I love Wim. He's a great guy. You're like, I'm going to debunk this weird Dutch fitness guru guy who says he can do these, frankly, superhero kind of things. And really, the ability to say, I'm going to control my body temperature. I'm going to turn my immune system up and down just by thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, I've taken down lots of these, you know, sham guru people. I'm going to take this guy down. So what did you do?
Yeah. So, you know, I had just written this huge article for Playboy about how meditation can kill you, right? Especially for people who get attracted to that idea of superpowers and pursue those superpowers to their like maximum extent. I found lots of stories of people who actually died. One guy who died in the mountains of Arizona, who ended up being a book that I wrote called The Enlightenment Trap. And I'd also witnessed people in my earlier life when I was doing meditation in northern India and Tibet. I actually knew somebody who committed suicide on a meditation retreat in the pursuit of enlightenment. The last lines in her in her book, where in her journal, where I'm a bodhisattva, which means I'm basically an enlightened angel. And so I was like super, super skeptical and of anyone who promises these you know, almost magical powers. And when I saw Wim Hof in 2011, Wim Hof was basically a circus act with a very little bit of, you know, he had like a commercial with Columbia Sportswear. That was about, yeah. That was what he was known.
He didn't have the science studies around lipopolysaccharide injection. And like his stuff is legit, at least for some people, but some people get frostbite and other stuff too. Just any path, including the Buddhist stuff you talked about. And I've actually read that book a long time ago. I mean, I've spent time in Tibet like you. They tell you, if you go for the fast path, you could get enlightened. You could also die and go nuts. And like this is in their teaching because they know it. So yeah, meditation is not without risk, although most of the stuff we do in the U.S. is pretty low risk, but not always.
Yeah, so. Not always. And I'm very aware of that not always side of things. You know, I lived in India for 6 years. I saw a lot of people moving there on these spiritual paths. And I just sort of observed a greater share of insanity than what the normal meditator.
Yeah, but you have a selection bias. Okay. You're right. There's something not right in my life. I'm going to move to India for a long time to go make it right. So you might have had a greater percentage than average, but also sometimes people are just attracted there for, you know, a beautiful reason and they find what they're looking for and they come back and change the world. So you're like, flip a coin, which is it going to be? Who knows?
Right. Totally. But so you know, put that's just to contextualize. Then I saw Wim Hof. He's a naked sitting on he's a shorts on, and he's sitting on an iceberg somewhere north of the Arctic Circle. And there's this photo of him, and he says that I can train you to control your immune system, to control your body temperature. And I was like, bullshit. You're gonna get people killed. And so, you know, I searched around, I got a magazine to cover my flight to go out there and meet him. And this was actually his very first organized training session.
Wow. Ever. That's cool.
I was the first guy on it. There were two other people there, one Croatian and one Latvian, and that was it. Like, Wim Hof was really an unknown at this point.
Yeah.
And so I get off the plane and he looks like this. I mean, when you first meet him, Wim Hof is not an impressive looking guy, right? He's sort of short. He's got a big ruddy nose, big blotched red skin. He was wearing a felt hat, a green felt hat that made him look like a garden gnome. Like,
I mean, here's the deal. Wim does not care what you think of him. I mean, you know this because you know him and we're friends as well. I really appreciate him as a human being. But yeah, he just doesn't care, which is kind of cool and also a little bit off-putting if you don't know what you're getting into.
Right. And I was like, you know, well, this is going to be the easiest job of my life. Like, you know, he's already discrediting himself. And he's also talking what sounds to me like disorganized madness. I mean, you know, he's like, we're going to win the war on bacteria. You're going to give me the Nobel Prize. And like, he talks in these sort of disconnected sentences.
He's not linear. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's sort of all over the place. And so, you know, and at this point, there's no real science. There's not much science on him. Like, I think there'd been one study. So we drive out to his training center in, you know, the mountains of Poland. This is January. At this point, I had been living in Los Angeles. So I go from palm trees to the winter that stopped the Nazi army. Okay. Put that in context. Mm-hmm. And we're in the mountains and I get out of the car and it's like this dilapidated farmhouse and it's like really crummy. Right? And I walk upstairs and I look out the back window, you know, store my rucksack, and I see this dude sitting out back. It's not Wim. It's one of like, sort of a guy who just like sort of followed him. And he's in his underwear in this snow field, throwing snow on his chest and there's steam coming off of him. And I was like, wait, what? Like, and my mind is not even really thinking about the steam as much as like, who is this insane person doing this? And you know, as a journalist, you have a couple options for how you cover someone, right? You can go in there and sit back and say, okay, I will watch you from a distance. I will watch your breathing and whatever, and I will write an article about that. Or you can jump in and give an experience. And at that point, I hadn't truly decided on what I was going to do because I did think it was dangerous. And then I had this, you know, long conversation with Wim at night. We were playing chess and just sort of talking into the evening. And I was like, oh, he is really genuine. Like beneath that madness, beneath that crazy exterior, there's something which is so pure. And like, he believes it that I was like, you know what? I'm going to give you a chance. I'm going to do your stuff.
There's not there's not even 1% of con artist in his energy. I love the way you describe him. He's the real deal.
Yeah, he is. And so I do his method. And, you know, the first time, you know, it's essentially hyperventilation, exhaling, and then breath retention. That's the breathing part of it. And you do a bunch of sessions of this. And then at the end of that, you do another hyperventilation session, exhale, and then you start doing push-ups. Now, at this point, I could hold my breath for maybe 30 to 45 seconds. I timed it. And I could do about 20 push-ups. You know, I'm not a super athlete, will never be a super athlete, but that's what I could do. And so I just do his breathing, and I'm holding my breath for 3 minutes after an hour of breathing. And I do 40 push-ups with no air in my lungs, and they felt easy. And I was like, boom. Like, this was the moment where I was like, I don't know what he's got, but he has got something, and I really have to learn it. And then he does this next thing, which is like, all right, now, Scott, you know, go out and stand in the snow, right? And it's because the Wim Hof method is really breathing, cold exposure, and then he has this thing called mindset, which is a little difficult to understand. It's not really well described. So we go out in the snow, and the first thing that happens is it hurts. It hurts really badly because I had never intentionally exposed myself to that extreme of a temperature change. And what is occurring physiologically is vasoconstriction, which means all of the arteries in your body have smooth muscle in them, and they contract on external exposure. You can't really do it with your mind very easily. If you've never put your feet in snow before, you've probably never experienced that feeling, and it hurts. And Wim, you know, I stand there and for 5 minutes, and I'm just like, oh man, I do not want to be here. And Wim's like, okay, you can go inside after 5 minutes. I just like hit my limit. And I said, well, Wim, this method sucks. Like, I'm not like the push-ups were cool, but this sucks. And he's like, and then we go into a sauna, right? But then I have the opposite reaction, which is called vasodilation, and the arteries pop open, warm blood goes through cold tissue, and it hurts even more.
Oh yeah. That part sucks.
Totally. And then the next day, he's like, okay, you know, next day you'll do it and it'll be better. And next day, I'm standing in the snow and I last 10 minutes before I get to that same spot. And the day after that, it's 20 minutes. Fourth day, it's 45 minutes. And on the fifth day, I climb up a mountain in my bathing suit with 2 degrees, you know, just totally exposed. Like, is the adaptation to that, what would look like extreme cold is so incredibly fast, that I couldn't believe it. And I found this sort of power. And, you know, and the crux of my book is this, are these superpowers? Is this manna from heaven coming down and like you're powering yourself? Or is this something else? Is there another explanation? And what it is that there is an evolutionary, powers that we all have,
yes,
that we all inherited.
They're untapped, right?
We don't touch it. We live in our like warm houses. It doesn't matter if it's like 30 or like negative 20 outside or 120. We have air conditioning and modern heating to keep to keep us fine. But we evolved as winners. Like, we evolved in constantly varying temperatures, and we don't have those variations anymore.
But one of the things that still sticks in my mind, in fact, within actually the same day that I first had yak butter tea when I'm in Tibet.
Pucha.
Yeah. It's 10 degrees below zero.
Yeah.
And there's a 30 mile an hour wind. Mm-hmm. It's getting a little bit late. And I've got a porter with me. And he's showing off for the young Australian girl who's there. And okay, this guy's half my size. He's wearing thin, you know, Chinese knockoff Levi's, fake Nikes, and a vinyl, barely lined leather jacket. Like kind of wanted to be a leather jacket with a little bit of flannel on there. And a t-shirt.
Right.
Okay. Uh-huh. I'm wearing like a proper parka. I've trained in mountaineering. I understand, you know, environmental exposure. And he's jumping up and down on a frozen lake to show off for the Australian girl. And he falls through up to his waist. Okay. So he comes out of there, kind of laughs a little sheepishly. And I'm like, okay, we got a survival situation here. This guy's wearing cotton, which they say cotton kills when you're a mountaineering kind of person.
Totally.
And like, it's freaking cold and there's no air and like all the bad things you can think of. So I had an extra insulated parka and I pull it out of my backpack and I give it to him And he looks at me and goes, okay. And he puts it in his basket to carry for me. And then I go, there's no language. I'm like, no, for you. And he goes, not cold. And I'm like, this guy is a superhuman. It is not possible. He's carrying more than I am. He's running up and down. And that just blew my mind. And I'm like, either it's a genetic thing. And there actually is a genetic high altitude thing amongst the Sherpa people. But even beyond that, like this guy was just made of something different, or he could. And to your point, in I think it was in Headstrong, I found the research about cardiolipin levels changing over 3 days. It might even be in Game Changers. But that's why you adapt so quickly, is that it takes 3 days of cold exposure and your cell membrane mitochondrial composition changes, cardiolipin levels go up, and suddenly your power goes up. I'm like, it's always been there, but we just don't know it's there.
Right. I mean, you know, if you think about the process of evolution, which is basically death after death after death after death, we are the ones who lived, right? We are the boys who lived and the girls who lived. And the reason they lived is because they change quickly, right? They didn't have the biological systems that said, oh, you know, storm's coming, I'll get ready next month. It's like, no, storm's coming, you're getting ready now. And we inherited that. Our species is 300,000 years old. The life on the planet is, what, about 5 billion, multicellular, 1 billion, roughly. We inherited the ability to adapt to the environment. And the fact that we don't do that now, and, you know, this guy, you know, this Tibetan guy is a great example. He probably lives in a generally low technology lifestyle.
Yep.
And probably his ancestors were even more technologically, insulated. But we now pursue this comfort, this idea of like, oh, my body's a little bit out of homeostasis. I'm going to flip a button, put on a parka, you know, do something to my environment to make me feel good. But our bodies are not meant to do that. Those are signals. Feeling a little chilly is not the signal of I need to go save myself from imminent death. It's like, oh, my metabolism's heating up. No, that's actually what that sensation is. And if we pay attention to these sensations, we have some ability to control them and adapt them to our own will.
You wrote in your book that there's a growing consensus among scientists and athletes that we were not built for eternal and effortless homeostasis. And that we need to kind of stress not that damages muscles, but environmental and physical oscillations.
Yeah.
So what other evidence do we have that we really need those oscillations?
It is really everywhere. I mean, there's this idea of hormesis, which is really quite popular, right? Yeah. Which, and you've probably written about this, yes, right? Where is you get a stress, and that stress is what makes you stronger. So, you know, even just something as simple as lifting weights, right? And, you know, I'm not a big weightlifter, but if you lift weights, that is a stress on your body. And then you feel sore afterwards. And that feeling of soreness is actually your muscles forming new connections, tears, repairing them, inflammation, which then makes you stronger. Anything in our system that we stress, our system has to adapt or it fails. And because we're incredibly adaptable, you know, you have to look at the environment as a sort of exercise on its own, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we usually think about human health as on two pillars, right? Which is the stuff you put into your body and then the way you move yourself to use that stuff, right? That's in general every diet that's out there. What I've found over the course of, you know, the years of research is that, no, there's this third pillar, which is the passive way the environment works on you all the time in every way. And those sensations that are coming in. And if you adapt that environment and you now see that there's a three-part system, now you have tools that you can use. You can change your environment in a way, like you can go into superheated rooms if you wanted to. And that trains certain systems and not trains others. You know, it's truly amazing. You know, you go up to high altitude, you're going to build more red blood cells. Like, our bodies are so adaptable. Why not engage those systems and try to use them?
It makes a lot of sense to me. And this idea that, you know, biohacking is the art of changing the environment around you and inside of you. Even your gut bacteria respond to temperature around you and oxygen composition in the air. And the whole Upgrade Labs thing that I'm doing, breathing air with no oxygen in it, or hyperoxygenated, mm-hmm. and cryotherapy and light right. therapy, all of those are just manipulations. And
totally.
I've reached the point where I believe, Scott, that we can receive some amount of signal from our environment around us, but that mm-hmm. the coldest place on Earth is not as cold as liquid nitrogen. And mm-hmm. the hottest sunlight doesn't have as much red light as what you can get from a red LED light. And there's just so many things where we can trick our bodies by getting a stronger signal than they're supposed to have to cause adaptation to give us those, quote, superpowers mm-hmm. That are out there. And there's emerging science in each of those areas. But to pull it all together and say, I wanted to live longer or feel better, there's definitely a path there that scientists are eking out right now. But mm-hmm. even without some of those crazy things, you did some stuff that most people would consider superhuman, like 80 push-ups in a single breath. You lost seven.
Well, I did 30 breaths first, but yes.
Well, it doesn't matter. You know, you hyperventilated first. I get you. 7 pounds of fat lost in 7 days, mm-hmm. and you melted the banks of a river. You're sitting around ice and all that, which is a classical Tibetan or even Chinese medicine practitioners oftentimes learn how to do that.
Totally.
But still, that's a superpower right there. You're controlling your temperature, and you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in shorts, which is okay. So these are all kind of superpower things for a journalist, yeah. right?
Yeah, right. Put down that pen, man. Yeah, right.
No, but I mean, like, you're not a pro athlete. You know, you're not a quote superhero. Mm-hmm. Although I guess Superman was a journalist. Come to think of it, as a news reporter.
Hey, yeah, so. Yeah. You can kick my butt though. Don't worry. It's like, totes. Not. you know, here's the thing. Like you said, you know, the cold of liquid nitrogen is colder, absolutely, than ice water. And I see where you're coming from. And I think that there's a my preference is actually for natural stimuli. Not to say that you can't find stuff with like really high tech stuff, but you know, in the movie of my life, which I'm hoping is going to be Rocky IV, which has that montage in it, right? Where you have Ivan Drago on one side, where he's, you know, the USSR big bad dude. Mm-hmm. And he's working out in a lab, like, and they're injecting him with stuff. Who knows what that is? Like, and they're measuring everything. And then on the other side is Rocky, who's like pushing wagons through the snow and jumping in water and like doing stuff. It's a great montage. You should find it on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
I am of the opinion that using the natural world that we have available to us offers us such an amazing variety, and it's free usually, that you can just get in there and really get a lot of training and sensations that are really useful. And when you talk about cryo, I have really looked at cryo and I really wanted to like it. And having done several sessions now, my feeling is that it's best employed for removing skin tags, if you have like those little skin tags that show up, because you can freeze them right off. But I actually feel like an ice bath, a proper ice bath around 33 degrees, is more intense than a cryo session.
Oh, of course it is.
Because you get more stimulus. The thermodynamics, it's like way colder because you actually move heat because water moves heat a lot better than air does. And you have this air gap in the cryo. Like if you really went down to negative, 300 and something, like it's zero Kelvin.
Yeah.
That would kill you. Right. So, mm-hmm. so I find them a little bit, I don't find them as impressive as I have had the experiences in ice bath and going from like a sauna to an ice bath or things like that. What we see so well, eye to eye, and you and I, and I'm reading your book, I was like, oh man, Dave gets it. Cause I didn't read your book while I was writing my stuff because I don't like reading people who are too similar to me.
Yeah.
Because
I'm like, it soaks in.
And like, I don't want to sound like you. You sound great.
When I was writing Game Changers, I had not read Tools for Titans at all. In fact, I still haven't read it. So I'm like, I don't want to. And then I was like, oh, good. That was a collection of sort of essays from each one. And mine had the through line in it. But I was like, I don't want any pollution there. So I respect that about you. And it is something that a lot of my favorite author friends choose to do.
But then, you know, I've written the book and I was reading your books this week in preparation for the interview. And the thing that I find so compelling about what you're saying, which we are totally on the same page on, is that, you know, you exist in an environment and you create an environment for the stuff inside of you. And that what we're doing by modulating our external world is we're also modulating our internal world. And we sort of sit at this sort of fulcrum point. between, you know, whatever our mind is, right, is just at one place. And then we have these whole worlds below us. I mean, you talk about mitochondria and like, what's that mitochondria experiencing when I drink coffee? Like, it's getting a very different message. And then my mind is getting a different message, but it all adds up to a complex system of who we are. And then, you know, you can take it further and say all of humanity is connected. All of the world is connected in a big, you know, you could go to Gaia. You could go to, you know, you can just say
it's a big system. I mean, we know that's true.
Yeah. Right. And because we have our minds and we have the ability to manipulate things for our own betterment and hopefully, ideally, betterment of everything, you know, at the end of the day, that make the world a better place.
You nailed it. And it's funny because what I learned over the course of, you know, having weighed 300 pounds and having a chronic illness, frankly, all the diseases of aging before I'm 30, mm-hmm. is that I could spend all of my money and all of my time getting better. Mm-hmm. In fact, mm-hmm. it's a very common thing for people who have, you know, Lyme disease or toxic mold or whatever. They get bankrupt right. along the way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm lucky I spent $300,000 getting better, but I made $6 million that I then lost. But at least I had enough that I could recover. But
right.
it's the time. Okay, I'm a dad. I do the show. I write the books. Oh, and I'm CEO of a venture-backed company. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm looking at what's the ROI on spending 20 minutes in an ice bath, including the time to draw the bath, you know, chill it. And I have a digital temperature controlled ice bath. So it's not like it's that hard to do. But I got
in your house?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's pretty cool.
I wish I had one.
It has a little pump that recirculates it. And because the water's flowing, it's even worse than a normal ice bath because you don't get a bubble of heated water around you.
Totally, totally.
So it just drains you.
I'm so guilty of like being really still in an ice bath. Like, oh, if I move, this gets real bad. So just, you know.
Exactly. And this one, you still doesn't matter. And just to be clear, it is made out of an agricultural stock tank because mm-hmm. that made it cost effective. But I don't use it that often because it takes whatever, a half hour of rigmarole and I got to towel off. I get right. 3 minutes in cryo and I know I'm only hitting my peripheral temperature receptors. It's enough of a right. signal in 3 minutes that I can mm-hmm. be back on the show within 5 minutes when I decide to do it. So I'm sure. looking at the ROI for all these activities. And then, you know, do I hit myself with a red light before or after mm-hmm. when I do it? Because if I can shrink my cells a little bit with cold and I increase mm-hmm. the number of electrons with the red light, I'll do the red light after, which is probably going to cause improvements in mitochondrial function. So now I got a multiplicative effect. And here's mm-hmm. the deal. I'm just so lazy and I have stuff I want to do because I got to play ping pong with my son because he's like about to beat me. Like I need to get some practice in, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And so for me, it's that how do I fit these natural methods in that oftentimes take a long time with the stuff that yeah. I actually want to do that isn't natural. Like what we're doing mm-hmm. over, you know, over our mm-hmm. podcast right now, it's not natural, but it's kind of right. cool. How right. do you balance out that, you know, I want to be rustic and I want to do cool stuff?
Well, you know, I value my time incredibly much more than I do money, right? And yeah, and too. So I you know, I don't own an ice bath, I don't own the contraptions for it, but I do have snow outside in the winter, right? And I can go out and you know, when I was writing the book, I would do these shirtless runs around the lake outside of my house. And you know, to acclimatize myself to cold and come back. And I generally think that you should work out in whatever environment is going on outside at the time, because while cold is awesome, there's also a bunch of heat things that are really important too. And okay. there's also some nice spring 75 degree weather things that are also great. And I really think that we are connected to our environment and we need to use those signals more so than we just need cold. Although if a friend of mine's drawing an ice bath, I'm like, awesome. I'm coming to come over and jump in. So I often take opportunities that are available to me more so than creating them around me in a constant regimen, with the exception of I do the Wim Hof breathing protocols every single morning. I take a cold shower every single morning. I do the push-ups and that whole thing because that really centers me and before I start anything.
Yeah, having a daily practice is also powerful in its own right. Mm-hmm. When you were researching your book, Scott, who are the most memorable people that you trained with? I mean, you're basically growing superpowers. That's what I'd call mm-hmm. it. So tell me like the two most, like, I can't believe I did this kind of things.
Well, I think Wim Hof is the obvious one,
of course,
right?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I hung out with him for a long time and he is, you know, he's amazing. I love the guy. Like, I think he's crazy. I don't think he's a prophet. I think he's a madman, but I think that he has opened up the door to a way of thinking about the body that no one else could have. So mad respect to Wim.
And here's the deal, just for people who are listening to this, the people who are most interesting are so far from average, which mm-hmm. is another word for normal. So it's yeah. totally cool. Like, that guy's nuts, but he did something special. And right. we're going to learn from that. And Wim is a little bit more than nuts, and in a good way. Like he's got mm-hmm. some kind of a thing in there that it has a spiritual vibe to it. And totally. But yeah, he's not at all in the same universe that you and I are in, Scott. But that's okay.
Right. All right. Yeah.
I don't want to say anything bad about Wim because he does not deserve any hits like that. At least not in my assessment of him.
Sure, and you know I find myself pretty fair in Wim in the book, right?
Yeah,
I see his positivity as so far outweighing his negative traits, but you always have to also remember that there's this balance. You know, people who are on the extremes exist on this balance.
You're also a trained journalist, which means you will never write a one-sided piece. You'll right. always say, okay, even if you're like, this is the most amazing thing ever, there will be a paragraph in there. And by the way, Quackwatch yeah. says he's a bad man or whatever.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't go after Quackwatch, but yes,
I'm just saying like as general. A source or whatever, but you got to yeah. find a counter source. I'm just saying, cause all the people that I know and respect the most have been targeted by Quackwatch. So I always look at that. They're my favorite. Mm-hmm. They're my favorite like counterpoint. So when I finally got mentioned from the Quackwatch guys, I was like, career goal met. That was something I've wanted my whole life, but I'm not a doctor, so I don't really qualify, but they got me anyway. Right. I'm like, thank you guys. Anyway, sorry to go off on a tangent there.
Totally.
But the point is you always find a counterpoint because mm-hmm. you're a trained skeptic and to write a balanced piece, you must. So even when you're writing about Wim, I'd say generally you're pretty positive, but you dig for the holes.
Well, also I experience the holes, right? Yeah. I write about my experience. I don't do that whole fair and balanced thing where you need one source to counteract another source. What the way I view it is that if I see something, I write my honest reporting of that. I try not to spin it.
That's good.
There's always going to be spin. But if I see something like Wim, for instance, we walked up Mount Kilimanjaro, he did something that could have gotten us all killed. And there was a mutiny and 25 of the people left the group and I followed him up to the top of the mountain.
Wow.
That's the end of the book. That's the end of What Doesn't Kill Us. And I'm following up. Everyone has left him. It's just Wim and I and one other dude. And we're going up the mountain together. And I'm following him, you know, probably 75% because I'm a journalist. I'm like, well, I got to go see the end of the story. And the other 25 is like, okay, well, but I can do this. And the end of the book is actually quite interesting. And so I'm just going to give it away to everyone who's listening to you as a bonus, but you're going to love the journey anyway, which is that anyone's journey with personal health, with improving themselves, is not about another person, right? It's about their own journey. And I realized at some point when I see Wim, he makes a trip at somebody. He sort of stumbles a little mm-hmm. bit and catches himself. I'm like, you're not God. You're not a prophet. You're not anything like that. You're just a crazy dude who has this really cool idea. And I'm a crazy dude who also has this idea, right? And then you know, I follow up and I realize that, look, this is my journey, right? This is my journey. This is not just Wim's journey. And that is very liberating to be able to hold two concepts at the same time. One, Wim is a prophet, and two, Wim is a madman, and say, it's all right, because we're all like that. We're all flawed individuals in a million different ways, but we can find the good, we can accentuate the good. And that's, you know, that's the dream. So to answer the other half of your question, mm-hmm. who were the other people I met who were amazing? I hung out with Laird Hamilton, the legendary surfer.
Yep.
He did his XPT training. I saw a very early stage of it. He's a very inspiring, very intense guy, and you know, mad respect to him. Brian McKenzie, the founder of High Intensity Interval Training. He was one of the first HIIT guys out there. Really, really startling intellect on him and determination. You know, really proud to have you know, been friends with him even after the book has come out. So that's really cool. And then, you know, another fun thing that I did, which sort of ties into some of the ways to develop superpowers, is I did this race called the Tough Guy, which is supposedly the coldest obstacle course race in England. And they hold it traditionally on the coldest day of the year. And people show up and they're in wetsuits, right? And it's like, you know, the normal obstacle course yeah. races, there's mud and nets and all that shit, you know, stuff. And I line up, of course, in my bathing suit. And I wish I'd had a Speedo, but I couldn't find an American flag Speedo. So I was just in a normal bathing suit. And And, you know, the gun goes off and everyone's like shivering and I'm shivering and I'm like, why am I doing this? And then we go.
You intimidated everybody. That was why. Okay. That's just kind of badass. Anyway, keep going.
And I'm a terrible runner. Just incidentally, the guy who won the race did it in like an hour and a half, right? I took like 3.5 hours to finish this race. But it's freezing. People are going to this hypothermia tent and I'm running with this like just huge grin on my face, basically naked and enjoying every last minute. And here's the trick that I used, which is that at first I felt that cold on my skin and I was like, it's there. It's cold. That sensation is cold. But I told myself, no, that sensation is not just cold. It's the sensation of the joy that I have of doing this crazy race, of like jumping over things. Because I like jumping over things. I like going under things. I like having those challenges. And all of a sudden, what happened is that it transformed into the physical experience of joy for me and heat. And I wasn't cold at all on this trip where other people were having a really miserable time because they think of themselves as fighting this environment. And I'm like, no, I'm just in it, man. And yeah. I gave up any hope of winning because I never really had one. And then I was just there for the pure experience of it. And then because it wasn't a lethal environment, like I'm not on the moon or anything like that. I'm not in ice water for that whole time. It just became this really fun meditation. And that's one of the things that I think that is achievable for anyone who does these methods. You don't have to go climb up Mount Kilimanjaro in a super fast time in a super skimpy outfit. Like you can do these things and then just use these mental switches to say, look, I have these sensations coming in. I'm going to create a new association for that. And in many cases, that can also build resilience.
I think resilience is a key word there. And one of the things that I've found in the course of doing neurofeedback to find out what's really going on in my brain is what right. you just described there around struggle. When you stop mm-hmm. struggling, all the effort, the electrons that went into the struggle, they got to go somewhere and they could go in mm-hmm. towards keeping you warm. But that whole, like I'm fighting against something, it mm-hmm. doesn't work very well. Because when you fight against something, right. it usually gets stronger and you get weaker. Right. But if, like you said, you're experiencing it, you're not struggling, you know, you're performing and you might fail, but at least you're doing it.
Right.
It's kind of a sense of liberation there. And I think that's an element to a lot of the stuff in here where you stop resisting the painful stuff. I've noticed like when I'm doing really intense, like rolfing, or when I'm getting, you know, 100 injections of mm-hmm. stem cells or mm-hmm. I had my bone marrow taken out for stem cells without anesthesia. And it's like, you can be like, you know, and fight it. Or you can just be like, I'm going to welcome this because this is part of the experience. And it doesn't hurt. Like, I mean, it hurts some, but it's like 5% as much as it would have been.
Right.
And so there's some switch. And you write about something called the wedge. How is the wedge tied to that switch we're talking about?
So the wedge is incidentally the title of my next book, which should be coming out in the future, whenever that is. I just finished the manuscript and you know, we're going through this process. But the wedge is really what I see as the heart of the Wim Hof method and the heart of a lot of training out there, which is that you have a sensation coming in from the environment. And that thing is its objective truth, right? Mm-hmm. The blizzard, right? The blizzard is happening and that hits your skin initially or your sensory system in some way and enters your body. And now in that sensory system, your senses frame what's coming into your body in some way, just because the neurons, you know, there's electrical impulse that moves through. And if you talk about pain, like, you know, someone stabbed you in your bone for the bone marrow extra, mm-hmm. You know, where does that pain occur? Does that pain occur in your bone, or does that pain occur in your brain? The truth is the pain occurs in your brain. So it has to actually travel from one location to another to actually be anything. So sensation comes in and it's actually more or less meaningless. It doesn't have a lot of intrinsic value. It enters to the lowest part of your brainstem in most pathways. And it immediately will trigger any sensation will immediately trigger a homeostatic response. So if it might change your heart rate, it might change your thermoregulation, might change some immunopathways. And that's just like hardwired into like what you are. But it still doesn't have any meaning. It's just like, this is what your brain did automatically, lowest level of the brainstem. It goes in from there. And then there's this really fascinating thing that occurs where sensation goes from meaningless to having to find meaning. It has to look for meaning somehow. And the way we process anything is it we in the, what do you call it? The affective nervous system, by and large, we bond our emotional state at the time of sensation to the sensation. And it creates roughly a symbol, like a little package. And that package, next time you experience that same symbol, or that same sensation, instead of like packaging your current emotional state, it reaches back to that initial emotional state and it just relives it. So anytime you sense anything, you're actually reliving your past.
Exactly.
And so now when you realize that that's the way we work, you can start thinking, okay, well, if I have a positive emotional, you know, and this is also power. I didn't invent this by any way. This has been we've been talking about this for thousands of years, but if I have like a positive spin on something as it's coming in, I'm going to have future better associations with that thing and better associations now, and also better outcomes. As long as you don't go down the insanity route, you know, as long as you don't flip over to the next end.
Yeah, I found, and this is kind of weird. I just want to get your take on it because you've dug in on this stuff like I have. So given that I get really relaxed around any of these sort of things, I'll find myself going to sleep during rolfing. Okay, if you've had rolfing, they're like reaching through your muscles and all. And the very experienced rolfers I've worked with, like, I've never seen anything like this. Like you just go to sleep, you wake up an hour later and I could do anything I want. I'm like, I don't know, it just kind of happens. But I found my heart rate was dropping too low during some of these procedures. So I started listening to like Jane's Addiction or Rage Against the Machine or something like that. I'll actually turn that on headphones to raise my heart rate so I don't just go to sleep.
Interesting.
What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're creating new symbols, right? Everything comes down to this neural grammar that we have. And you have probably gotten to a point in your head where you have a lot of control on your body, right? You have, you know, that stimulus is coming. You have a lot of control. And you're like, I'm going to go fully, you know, parasympathetic.
I'll just shut that down.
You know, instead of going from fight or flight, I'm going rest and digest. And because it's happening in your peripheral nervous system, it's not happening in your brain where the actual pain occurs. You've been able to rewire yourself. Right. And that's, you're a hacker, right? Yeah. I mean, no shock there. Right. So you're being able to rewire this. And then but maybe you pushed it too far.
I think I did. Yeah. So I get a little bit angry when they're going to do something. And then, but I don't really walk in anger. That's not an emotion that I usually sit with. And if I do, I usually, I'm like, I don't want to carry that around. It's too expensive. I'll get rid of that. So maybe I just need to get a little bit more pissed off at the doctor.
Well, but here's the interesting thing about any sort of interference with a system, right? Is that our system craves homeostasis; it craves a place to be, and it's going to find it naturally because of the environmental stimulus you have. We have the power because we're humans, because we're smart, to use interventions. It's something that I call the wedge. You can use other terminology for this as well. You can use interventions to mess with that to become to a new level of homeostasis in another environment. You can train yourself to do that. But it doesn't always mean you're smarter than your body, right? We're trying to do is expand our, if you think about a graph, right? And we have this in the center of the graph and there's two lines on either side. That's the zero point, and that's like absolute safety. And if we move ourselves towards danger on either side, there's going to be an absolute point where it's death. Okay. Mm-hmm. And our nervous system, when we get into that stimulus, which causes death eventually, it's eventually going to say, warning, 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 watch out. And resilience is getting as close to that death stimulus without causing damage.
Right.
And our body is gonna alert ourselves, usually very conservatively, be like, the temperature in the room is 62 degrees and I am going to die. You're not, but your body is going to signal this to you early. But then you can modulate and find that I'm working in this margin until I can get to a place. But at the end of the day, in the battle of man versus nature, nature wins every time. Hands down. Absolutely.
I'm with you there into the day. And that's how nature will listen to this environment. And I'm pretty sure we can do some tricky things in the environment that our bodies didn't expect. But end of the day, the body's going to listen more to nature than to you. Mm-hmm. All right. I swear I could do like three episodes because we didn't talk about very much the enlightenment trap about how meditation can make you go nuts, which is a real true thing. And we didn't talk about the 5 years you spent figuring out where you can go to buy organs, bones, and blood and things like that. So like you go deep and you're a well-storied and also a well-spoken journalist. It's really cool. Like I'm a fan of your work, Scott. So we didn't go into that stuff, but I do want to ask you something because you said you just finished your manuscript of The Wedge.
I did.
I am hopefully tonight finishing the final edits on my next book also for submission because my editor at HarperWave is really calling me every 5 minutes. So I kind of got to get that done. But this is a book about anti-aging and my quest to live to at least 180. Mm-hmm. And it's okay, I might die trying. And here's my
question. I mean, likely you're going to die trying, but you know, it's a great goal.
The worst I'll do is, you know, pursue the goal and live better along the way for doing it. So I feel like there isn't a big downside there other than that I'll be embarrassed after I'm dead. Oh, wait, I won't. So like you can't lose, but I honestly think it's an achievable goal or I wouldn't have said it. Mm-hmm. And my question for you is how long do you want to live given what you know about organ trafficking and enlightenment and freezing your ass off? How long?
Well, this is the, I was hoping you would ask this question, Dave.
Awesome.
I'm gonna tell you. Cause you know, I think that death is our greatest teacher in the world.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that we will cease, it creates, you know, and it's going to happen, guys. You know,
the end of the universe is going to happen. Like we are all going to die. I'm with you there.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And at some point, you know, and no matter what, how it happens, I can guarantee you that death comes in the, if life was a song, the song is going to end in a minor key. Death is going to suck. Okay. And I think we can take these as given. It's going to suck.
Haven't you seen someone who's like died surrounded by friends at peace? Like really, like
still going to suck.
You think?
I still think that.
Talk to some hospice workers. There's the occasional, the one in 10,000 person who's like, I'm dying at peace. Like I've seen that.
Okay. Maybe there's this, but let's just not take that as a given, right?
It is very likely to suck. I'll give you that.
Okay. Very likely to suck. You know, with maybe a statistical error that proves the point.
Okay. Fully own that.
And I think that this is actually, if we really inhabit this, and I've seen a fair amount of death in my time. I was a war correspondent. I've seen friends die. You know, I've been in these places. And I think what this happens is when and Americans are very, very hesitant about death.
Yeah.
Right? We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it. We don't, you know, and when it happens, it's like no one wants to talk to you about it happening because it happened to that person. It's like contagious. You know, it's
totally.
Like, really messed up around death. And I think that really, and I saw this internet meme the other day, and I'm just going to repeat it because it was a good meme, which is that the goal of life is to die young as late as possible.
Yes.
Yeah. And I want to, you know, live my life to the absolute maximum, fullest extent as I can. But the goal is not to fully fund my retirement account so that I can die comfortably in my bed at a late age. Like, no, the goal is not death, right? And the unspoken narrative of our society is that we want to be comfortable up until the end. My feeling is no, we want to have as many experiences as we can now. We want to take risks, even if those risks fail, even if some of those risks could kill us, right? We still want to take those risks because that is our imperative for being alive in the first place, because you're still going to go out in a minor key. Like that's going to happen. So in terms of my absolute age, you know, honestly, if I died tomorrow, which I hope I don't, I hope I last a long time, I will already feel like my life has been useful. I will feel like I've already done things that are great. I still feel like I hope I have many more chapters to come. But I think, you know, when there's no absolute number, I feel like you have to be good with death right now if you want to live a full life.
You know what you sound like? You sound like a guy who lived in India for 6 years.
But I wasn't on the spiritual path. I hung out in Tibet. I did. I hung out in North India, but like I was there because I was interested in the chaos of India. Like I was like so fascinated in that. But yeah, like I there is a spiritual message in all of this, and that's why we push ourselves, right? That's why you do biohacking. It's not because the biohacking is the goal, right? The goal is because you want to live an interesting and fun and fulfilling life.
It's the experience. Like, I wonder if that's possible. Like, let's find out. If it's not possible, or I just don't know how to do it, okay. Mm-hmm. But there's joy in discovery, right? And it's the seeking of joy. And I'm with you there. And I admire what you're saying, which is that, you know, I'd rather not do it, but you sound like you're at peace if it happens. And I'm the same way. There is a contingent of the radical anti-aging crowd, many of whom are my friends, who are death is abhorrent. And I like to think about my devout atheist grandfather. And he was on his deathbed, and he looked at my dad and he said, you know, now that I've lived my whole life and I've, you know, experienced all these things, and I'm really starting to think more about this whole afterlife religious thing. He says to my dad, and my dad's like, oh my God, he's going to convert. And he goes, and I'm more convinced than ever that it's all bullshit. Right. No, it was like, it was this final kind of joke. But then when he was actually, you know, in his last few minutes, he's like, you know what? I'm a scientist and, you know, PhD chemist, wrote for the Encyclopedia Britannica and, you know, storied career. And he said, you know, I've never done this before, so I'm going to be a curious scientist. I'm going to be curious about death. And he did die. I don't know if he was fully at peace, but he died with his family all around him of his own choice. He said, you know, I don't want to live on dialysis for the rest of my life, because if I fight really hard, I might be well enough to watch golf. He's like, I'm done.
Right.
So I'm just only drinking wine instead of water. You guys should all come around. And like, okay, that was a pretty good death, I got to say. And I just remember that I'm going to be curious about it. And that's the mindset that I'm open to, rather than fear, because fear is the mind killer. At least that was one of the laws in Game Changers.
Isn't that Dune? Isn't that Dune?
It is from Dune. I stole it straight up from Frank Herbert. I did. But it's like, you're not going to live well now, and you take away from all those things that you just valued there. And by putting this conversation about how long do you want to live, I want people to learn or to start thinking, what does old age look like, and what does death look like? And maybe it's different than I thought. And just to bring some awareness there, because I want a lot of really smart, highly energetic old people to learn from in my life, because they teach me a lot. I mean, we need more of that.
There's a fan of a Sandman series by Neil Gaiman?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so he has got this great line, because one of the characters is Death, right? And she's like a punk rock girl. And she has this line, which is, you know, all people live exactly the same amount of time, exactly one life. And I was like, whoa, you hit some deep spots. but it's so true. It's like we've got a certain amount of time on Earth, and we use it as best as we can. So if we have a lot of old people who are living really long lives, hey, that's fantastic. It doesn't mean Kurt Cobain didn't live a great life either, right? You know, he died at 27. He did. I mean, I don't know if I would have wanted to be Kurt Cobain, but he did a lot of cool stuff. And we can, you know, the goal, as you said, is it's joy. It's finding abilities and doing things and living the best life you can in the time that we have. So your friends who are like immortalists, you know, these people who want to live until the very end of the heat death of the universe or whatever it is their goal is, like, I find that a little pathological. I find that a little dangerous, because what will happen is they won't face the things that have on, you know, that every life form has in common, like every single cell creature, all the way up to the most complex animals. We all share the fact that we're going to die. And that has been the signal. That is actually the signal that controls your nervous system. That's the fight or flight response. That is the rest and digest response. Everything is responding to death. And we need to, I mean, not race towards it, but we need to be like, it's there.
But if you want to extend this back to some of your other work, Scott, death is a part of the environment, as in it exists. If you remove death from the environment, we have no idea what our biology will do. If you were actually immortal, as in a truck could hit you and it went, you might turn out to be like some big blob of cells, or, I mean, God knows, it's kind of an interesting thought experiment. I have no idea. And it actually might be interesting to find out, but I don't think I want to be truly immortal, because we've all read, you know, the curse of the immortal person is like, could someone kill me, please? I'm so tired of being alive. I've done everything. I'm bored. If that ever happens, my real goal is I'd like to die at a time and by a method of my choosing. And at that point, I mean, who can complain? But yeah, the end of death itself probably isn't good for human biology, but who knows? No one's ever tried it.
Yeah. Well, no, they've tried it. They've all failed. That we know of. That we know of. This is true. Fair enough.
All right, Scott. This has been a fascinating interview. Your new book that isn't out yet is called The Wedge, but the What Doesn't Kill Us book that you've written is a fascinating read for people who are listening who are fans of the interviews with Wim Hof or some of the other things. You've gone out and you've done some of this thing, some of those things I would call biohacking, that has given you those superpowers, and you write about them. And you did this as a non-pro athlete, as you know, as a journalist, a curious guy who was actually skeptical. So kudos for your work. I think you do a really good job communicating. I appreciate your books, appreciate your articles, and I appreciate you being on the show.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave. I really have enjoyed being here.
And you had a link. It was scottcarney.com/audible. People get some kind of a audiobook.
So here's the thing. Let's steal money from Jeff Bezos together.
All right, it's a deal.
So they gave me this affiliate link where if you click on it, and it, right now it's audible.com/whatdoesn'tkillus, but I'm also going to set up scottcarney.com/audible. And if you click it, you get 30 days of Audible for free, which is cool. And I get $75. And that means we're stealing that money from Jeff Bezos together.
Sweet.
Alternately, you could just go to Audible or wherever and download it. And that's fine, too.
All right.
Really, or you can get it from the library, read the book. But
and just to be clear, guys, I get nothing out of this deal. I just like Scott's books. So this is just a pure on, like, he does good stuff. If you're going to get it anyway, you might as well go to scottcarney.com/audible.
That's right. That's right. And you know, and all the old social media places, we're all there. Everyone is. You know where to find us in the virtual space.
C-A-R-N-E-Y is how to spell Carney. All right, Scott, thank you for an excellent interview and your curiosity and your willingness to go to the ends of the earth to figure out cool stuff. I'm a fan.
Great. Let's do it again sometime. Thanks.
Count on it.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.